Hey there, everyone. Welcome back. Brand new episode of Meskel and the Coach. Greg Meskel here, Coach Adam Krikorian there. And Coach, we dive right into a sport we know well, the game of water polo. And we are in the home stretch here, women's water polo, coming down to the end of the regular season. This coming weekend, the end of the regular year. And I know we're fired up for our final Pac-12 game of the year, USC versus UCLA. Rankings coming out today on Wednesday the 19th as we're recording this. UCLA, after their big win last weekend, jumping up to number one in the country, and then Stanford and USC, number two overall. And it just a treat to get to do one versus two. As you look ahead to the weekend, where's your excitement at for this big game?
Well, I'm just excited, Greg, that these teams are finally playing each other. We get some exciting games here instead of seeing some blowouts. And obviously, I have a... my take on it is it's great for our players, our U.S. national team players. The more that the playing in competitive games and with high intensity and high pressure, it's better for us and it's better for everyone. Honestly, it's a little bit more exciting, but it should be good. You know, I think this weekend's game will be fantastic as every UCLA SC game is. And last weekend's game, UCLA against Stanford, was I think a lot of people probably would say they were surprised Stanford lost at home. That's a tough place to win. You know, I think that's probably in the last 4 or 5 years maybe the first or second time that UCLA has beaten them up there, so it doesn't happen too often. But I don't think something they can't go underestimated is just, you know, the desire and the determination that a previous losing team has when they're playing a team that beat them the last time. And I think we saw that with Stanford playing USC and their ability to handle them at USC. SC had beaten them last time, and to me, Stanford looked more hungry. And I wasn't able to watch this past weekend's game between UCLA and Stanford, but I wouldn't be surprised if UCLA was a little bit more determined coming off the, well, I guess they hadn't lost to them yet, but they were lower than them in the standings, and Stanford may be feeling a little too good about themselves, and you know, there you have it. So it'll be interesting this weekend. SC beat UCLA last time they played, and so if you're going off of what I'm saying, then UCLA's got a little bit of a mental advantage. But SC lost to Stanford, and I'm sure Jovan will have his team geared up and ready to go. And it should be, I'd be surprised if it was anything but a one-goal game.
Yeah, that one's going to be at 1 o'clock Saturday at UCLA, so the home pool advantage there for the Bruins. What's interesting, and the rankings came out just moments ago here, and we were talking about it a bit before we started, but you have UCLA at one, and then you have Stanford and USC tied at two. And what's interesting about that is it went back to a point that you just mentioned, that these teams don't play each other that much anymore. I was looking back at some of the old schedules, and I want to say it was the 2009 season, which was your last year as a head coach on the women's side for UCLA. And I feel like you might have played Stanford like three or four times in the year, you know, as you got into the postseason. You played them a bunch in the last five weeks of the season, for example. And when something like that happens, and maybe the results are mixed, I think then you can have a true debate. You see it in college basketball and other sports where there are rankings where there are so many talented teams, and maybe they play each other multiple times, or there's so much strength at the top that you can say, well, hey, maybe A beat B, but C beat D, and you know, those are equally valuable. But in this situation, right, we have UCLA at number one, you have Stanford and SC at two, but Stanford just beat USC, ending their streak. And the way this poll tends to go is that kind of whoever won last, right, is kind of on top of the mountain. So it seems odd. I don't totally get it, and I don't know how all the voting works as far as, you know, it's not a public ballot in the sense of who every person is that votes, but just seems a little off there. Not that it matters all that much, but that it's not as clearly delineated 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, you know, I'll preface it by saying all of this, I could care less about that.
Yes.
But at the same time, I mean, people, we got to get this right. I mean, it is I wasn't surprised to see UCLA kind of leapfrog everyone. They just beat the number one team in the country, and that had handled SC. But it makes no sense that Stanford and USC are tied at second. When you consider, you know, a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago, Stanford, you know, they I think the final score might have been just a two-goal game, but they were up by four or five at one point. So it just doesn't make sense. And I'd even make the same argument that ASU and Cal are tied for fourth, and ASU had beaten Cal at their place just the last time that they had played, and neither team has lost. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that. Neither team has lost to anyone lower than them since, so it doesn't make sense. ASU should be four, and Cal should be five. But whatever. I funny, you know, I never knew you were asking me before we went on air if I was ever on the poll, or I think a couple years we had an SID who made those decisions. But outside of that, I never knew who was voting. And, that goes back to, I guess, again, the my point of just it really doesn't matter. And I think just last point I will make is, with these teams not playing each other that much, and not to take away from the importance of this game, SC UCLA is a rival game, always is super exciting, and there's always some pride on the line. But the reality is, since they haven't played that much, these games, you know, after this weekend's game, the key is going to be the coach and the team that's able to take what they learn from these little games and then make the proper adjustments that need to happen. That's ultimately going to be the team that ends up rising at the very end in Indianapolis, where the NCAA championships are.
Yeah, and so much of this coming weekend is kind of finishing out the regular season, but also getting a sense for what the postseason will look like. And you mentioned the NCAAs, but before that, you have all the conference tournaments that are going on, and that's where all these automatic bids get decided. And the MPSF, which UCLA and Stanford, just one of those conferences, but you have a lot of others that are really going to be a battle. You know, whether you look at some of the East Coast schools, CWPA and the MAC, where we got to give a shout out to VMI out of the MAC, the Virginia Military Institute, making their first postseason conference tournament. Just having a great year. Kind of, I think for many, kind of came out of nowhere in that conference. They've normally struggled there, but so they're in the mix. And then you go back west, and you have the Big West, of course, with the likes of UC Irvine and others, and then the Golden Coast and the WPA. So a lot of anticipation around that following weekend. And sometimes I wonder too. Everyone wants the one seed. You want to finish your regular season strong, right? And we're, of course, excited for this game that's coming up, UCLA-USC. But they all know they're going to that next weekend. Yes, the one seed is highly valuable, so I take nothing away from the effort that'll be put into this to this weekend, especially in the MPSF, among others, where the one seed kind of gets you past day one. But I just wonder, you know, you're the coach in this kind of situation, but kind of where your head is at when you know that you have kind of at least one, if not two more, very important weekends ahead as you try and also finish your regular season strongly.
Yeah, I think it always just depends on the team. You know, I've had teams before in the past where, and the younger the team, the less experienced the team, or if a team was struggling with their confidence, I felt like it was really important to put up a good game and to hopefully come out on top, because that would give us a boost mentally. But, you know, teams that have been around the block, you know, that have had some success, I never, you know, personally, I never thought that a win was going to make it or break it for us. So we took a little bit of a different approach depending on the team and the psyche of the team, and maybe even the psyche of our opponent, quite honestly. So, you know, we'll see. I think these teams are, at the end of the day, the best teams are the best teams because they're have talented players who are all very competitive. And once you get into the game, they all want to win very, very badly. But on a side note, going back to your VMI comment that just came up, is exciting to see. I think they took Wagner to an overtime.
They did.
Right, to an overtime game, which is great for them. Can you imagine? Brigitte Games, I believe, was either committed or very close to going to VMI before she ultimately decided to, I think, went to Cal, committed to Cal first. Can you imagine if she was on VMI? You know, what that would do?
That would be quite an ad for that team. Well, because she ended up starting at Golden West before she made USC, I believe.
She committed to Cal, I think played in the university games for the University of California at Berkeley, but then never ended up starting school there, went to Golden West, and then transferred to USC after Golden West.
Wow, I'm partially speechless. I mean, talk about the one that got away.
Right, VMI. Oh, that would have been huge for them.
Yeah, I mean they may have already had a conference crown or two under their belt. That's interesting. Great nugget there, Coach. We did not know that one coming in.
And going back to the rankings and kind of getting out of the sport of water polo, and you know whether rankings matter. I mean, we're both huge NBA lovers. And Greg, what are your thoughts? I mean, we have a series, who would have thought that, or maybe maybe people would have thought that the Chicago Bulls would be up 2-0, stealing two games in Boston against the number one seed. Did you ever expect anything like that to happen?
You know, well, after watching those crazy 1999 New York Knicks advance all the way to the finals, coming out of the bottom of their bracket, and of course that was a strike shortened season, but to be able to do what they did, as a lower seed, you always think it's possible, right? You think of the great, Denver Nuggets, right, beating the Sonics, or a couple of years back, when the Warriors, right, with the Baron Davis Warriors, they were able to pull off some magic as well, before they were the juggernaut that they are today. So I think you always assume it's possible, but I didn't really circle this one, you know. I think I presumed that the Bulls were probably better than an 8 seed. You know, that's kind of just where they were at. And the Celtics were able to overtake Cleveland there in the last couple of weeks as the Cavaliers faltered. So they weren't exactly a wire-to-wire 1 seed. You've got to add in the tragedy for Isaiah Thomas, which I have no doubt had an effect on game one, if that didn't bleed into game two as well. The Bulls oddly play amazingly well whenever they're televised by TNT. It's actually like a hashtag about this, like TNT Bulls. They just play out of their minds, regardless of what is actually going on. There's a lot of things in the brew there that kind of are making sense here for Chicago. And I was watching some of the sports talk radio shows today, and just kind of talking about that this is just a done deal for a lot of folks. They're just, you go down 0-2 at home, you're just not getting out of this. I'm not ready to call it that quickly, but it is certainly the surprise here of the first round to kind of see the way things are going there for the Celtics, who I think people were obviously expecting title. I'm not so fast. I think maybe expecting a battle with Cleveland at some point down the road.
Yeah, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I called this upset, but I'm honestly not that surprised. I mean, I think when people talk about Chicago, they thought that they were going to have a better season than they did, thinking about the talent they have.
Yeah.
And a couple, obviously, a superstar in Butler and a superstar and a very experienced and savvy player in Dwayne Wade. And then conversely, you look at Boston, and I'm a huge fan of their coach, Brad Stevens. But whenever I watched him play, and I love Isaiah Thomas, but whenever I watched him play, I was never blown away by their talent. They just seem to play together. They play hard. They play unselfishly. But they weren't, to me, they're not that incredibly talented. So I'm not shocked at all. And you wonder sometimes with some of these teams, especially the ones that have these experienced players like Dwayne Wade, I mean, how much are they actually putting into that regular season?
Yeah.
As has been discussed a lot with the schedule of these games and how tired they are. And, you know, you just wonder if they're just hoping to get in and then it's a brand new game and that's when they start bringing their best. And with all that being said, I think you have some really tough, hard-nosed guys on that Boston Celtics team. So I don't think this series is over. And I think they have a few days off before they play on Friday, which I think will be very important for Isaiah and the rest of his team to kind of regroup. And I wouldn't be entirely shocked if they came back and beat Chicago in Chicago in Game 3.
The one thing I thought kind of as this series started to unfold a bit and you saw the first two games go by, and this is not to slight the Celtics at all, but kind of wondered, you know, was their arriving at a one seed more their doing or more a lack of what Cleveland did to kind of finish out the season strongly? You know, the Cavs have gotten off to a fine start against the Pacers with a couple of wins here to start. They haven't, you know, been destroying Indiana, but they've done what they're supposed to do. It kind of just made me think, you know, what is this really a byproduct of? And now that the playoffs are on, you've talked about the idea that these kind of veteran guys, and who better than the Cavs, who just won the title and have some veteran guys, but who better to know, you know, when it's kind of time to hit the major on switch here for the playoffs?
Well, and I honestly think that this may be a stretch, but I think Cleveland really didn't care about being, as much as their coach Tyronn Lue said that they cared about being a number one seed, I don't think they cared. I believe Washington is their biggest threat, and they were the four seed. So in some ways, they were, in my mind, kind of avoiding them. They get to play Toronto, maybe Milwaukee, because Milwaukee, that series is tied.
Yeah.
So I think it's an easier, and Chicago was tough. So I think tougher than Indiana. So I think it was in some ways a ploy. And it's so funny to listen to LeBron talk. And, you know, I think he plays the mental game so much. And if you read his quotes over the last few weeks, he was saying, you know, we're in trouble or not in a good place, and to me, when he's saying that stuff, I don't know if he entirely believes it. I think he's always sending a message to the rest of his team.
Oh, 100%, 1,000%. He knows exactly what he's doing with that stuff.
Exactly, and then now he's saying, you know, we're really close to being good, so we're being where we need to be. So he's just, you know, instilling some confidence and some belief in his team. And he's got a really good sense of that stuff mentally, and that's what the great ones do, the great leaders and the great athletes do.
Well, and that's such an interesting strategy, right? And you have to be playing a certain caliber of sport to be able to use that method, right? If you're, for instance, a sport like the national team in water polo, one of your best players can't rely on, you know, cable news to circulate their thoughts. So if they want to say something to the team, they've got to say it to the team. But in the NBA, right, much more scrutinized, so you know the coverage is going to be there. It's an interesting kind of strategy. You know, maybe he kind of thinks, well, there's only so many times, and I've never been in the locker room. I don't know what goes on. Maybe there's only so many times he thinks that I can actually get up here in front of everybody and, you know, give the rah-rah speech or say the things that are going to get everyone fired up. But along the way, I can kind of, you know, for those that need the words, I can kind of drop them off here and there through interviews.
No doubt. These athletes are smart, and they use the media to their advantage. As much as they say they don't like it at times, they definitely use it to their advantage. And going to the opposite conference, I don't know if anyone saw or if you happen to see the David Fizdale, who's the Memphis Grizzlies, his press conference after the San Antonio Spurs loss that they had to them, and just just chastising the officials, and you know, and I think most people really enjoyed listening to it, and his disdain for the officials and the way they officiated the game. And I think he came out today, he was fined $30,000. I'm hoping something like that, that the club actually picks up the fine, right? Like,
yeah,
these owners that are making, not that David Fizdale isn't making enough money himself, but, you know, he was clearly, in my mind, you know, he's setting himself up, his team up for game three, and he's showing support for his team by saying that we deserve better, and guys like Mike Conley, who's been just a class act, doesn't get the calls because he treats the referees with respect. And there's some truth to that, you know, it's the squeaky wheel gets the grease,
yeah,
at times, and unfortunately we see it a lot even in our sport. Just an interesting blow up or tirade or strategy by Coach Fizdale.
I thought it was totally understandable. To your point, he knows what he's doing. You don't go in there and kind of give that talk without realizing that there's going to be a fine on the back end of that. But it's what we just talked about. It's kind of delivering your message through different mediums, right? He could stand on the court all day and yell at the refs, and maybe they tee him up here or there, but he doesn't let anyone else see kind of the same message, you know, and he's able to kind of have that passion, and everyone kind of repeats that, you know, final line about, you know, data and everything, and he's offering stats, and you want to laugh, but it's not a laughing matter for them, because there is something off about those foul numbers. You know, if you have some of the physical players that the Grizzlies do, like Zach Randolph, and there's just such a disparity like that, you see it in all sports, but you do kind of have to start asking questions. You know, how is there just no balance to that at all throughout the entire game? And I don't know necessarily that I would say that it's a Spurs thing either. I mean, they play the way they do, but you know, do they have some, you know, magic voodoo over the officials? I don't believe that either. So there needs to be some sort of balance there. And you kind of touched on the West Coast series, Clippers Jazz now even at one, and the Clippers are such an enigma when I think about kind of the NBA and playoff basketball. They have kind of been at this with this more or less the same group of this, you know, this Blake Griffin, Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan crew for quite a while now, and they've had a couple of breakthroughs. But I think if you ask the average fan 5 or 6 years ago where they kind of thought this group was headed, you think NBA Finals somewhere in there. You know, who could have seen the emergence of the Warriors and things of that nature? But I just don't think they've really lived up to their potential. I'm not out on a limb at all by saying that, but they're such a fun team to watch. They have so much talent. It boggles my mind sometimes that they haven't just been able to get it all together for one run. I know injuries have played a part, but they haven't been able to get it all together.
Well, I've actually used their team as an example for our team when speaking to our team, because I think, you know, as a Warriors fan, well, we've dominated that team, right, in the last 2 years. Beating them by 45, I think, once this year, but they still scare me to death because of the talent they have. But you know, they're a great example, and as I was saying before, they were a great example for me to use because I see their talent. But to me, when I look at that team, it just doesn't seem like the pieces fit. There's a ton of really good players, but you need players that are going to play their role and be happy with their role. And I'm not saying that there's guys on that team that are really selfish. I'm not sure of that. But, you know, as the coach and as a general manager of a team, you know, I've said this before, you're not selecting the best athletes or the best players. You're trying to select the best team and form the best team. And it's a good reminder for us all as coaches, and for even fans to recognize that it doesn't matter who and how talented everyone is, but they have to be able to work together. And that's clearly, and again, I think there's some great players and talented people that want to win. It's not like they don't want to win, but I just there's something about the cohesion there that to me is just obviously not working. Now they may move on at, you know, from round one, who knows, but I just don't see it connecting and working long term with this group.
I think that you've just described the fears of many Clippers fans that have kind of invested their hopes in this group for a while. And you remember DeAndre Jordan kind of flirted with leaving, and they were able to lure him back and kind of keep this unit intact. And they have, you know, it's a little bit like fantasy sports in a way, where they have put some really awesome names together, and they get you a lot of points, provided they didn't have to play together. But that's what this is about here. They've got to be able to work well together. And you see it sometimes, they look great as a unit, but then the overall, you know, season product, for whatever reason, it just hasn't fully clicked where they've been able to advance. And now, you know, as that group has kind of gotten on after a couple of years, now they're dealing with some really difficult teams in their way, like your squad, and we'll finish our NBA talk on the Warriors. But it seems like we're either talking about them winning or Kevin Durant's kind of injury status, and I know he's a bit up in the air for tonight's game, but you got to be pleased so far out to the 1-0 start, all things looking good otherwise.
You make it sound like I have some stake in ownership here. I love talking about my squad like it's like I have a share, maybe a 25%, or maybe it's
you wish you had 25% in that team.
I think Portland is, you know, everyone just says, oh, the Warriors have it easy and they're gonna make it all the way. But man, and maybe this is my approach as a coach always do. I'm scared to death of some of these teams. I mean, when you got guys like McCollum and Lillard.
Yeah.
I mean, those two are as good of a backcourt as there is. I mean, they're as good as Curry and Thompson. I mean, I know Curry and Thompson get a lot of credit, but
they're different, right? They're not just stand. You know, they're not just shooting experts. They can hit the three, but they're great in a different way.
Right, right. So I think this series is not going to be easy by any means. But I obviously like the squad if Durant is healthy and I like chances, but at the same time, Houston and San Antonio scare the you know what out of me. What's interesting for me to watch is with the teams like Houston and Golden State who play a little bit up tempo, and it's really important them to play with that style and pushing it. And I'm curious when things get tight, because and the pressure increases as you go in a series or go in the playoffs, because it's always been my take and a lot of people's take that you know what tends to happen is these games become more half court oriented, right? And I think a lot of that is the pressure. The pressure sometimes can paralyze teams to not play as free and as free flowing and with movement. And I think we even saw it with the Warriors in that Cleveland series. And so I'll be curious with those teams and see how they do. That's something that, as I just speak on our experience with our water polo team in Rio, one of the greatest things for me to be able to watch was our team still played with that freedom and that creativity and that fast pace. I was a little concerned whether we were going to be able to do that or not under the circumstances and under the pressure of an Olympic Games, but we did. And again, it would be something that I look forward to kind of keep an eye on as these playoffs roll on.
NBA playoffs resume tonight, of course, and seemingly are on every night, which is a wonderful thing for basketball fans such as ourselves. You touched on the Olympics, and a perfect segue to some talk about a change to the format of the Olympics, looking ahead towards the 2020 games in Tokyo. And as a women's coach, you've of course long been a fan of the idea of some gender equity in the Olympic Games. For those of you that don't know, in the sport of water polo right now, 12 men's teams are chosen, 8 women's teams. outside of that very clear disparity of four teams, the road for qualification is a much different one for example, the USA men and the USA women. The USA men have multiple opportunities, I believe up to four chances to qualify, where the women generally only have two, the Pan American Games and the qualification, and it was reduced to just one this last time around because of the Olympic Games being held among the Americas in Brazil. The one caveat to that adjustment and evening it up 12 and 12 would be the reduction of athletes, so taking water polo rosters from 13 down to 11. This obviously you can prepare for it now, Coach, but I know it would obviously dramatically change the way that you select probably and approach a game, and it seems like it has a decent chance of happening.
Well, it seems that way, and I, like you said, I've been a huge proponent and some gender equity here, and trying to get our women's Olympic format to 12 teams, and I'd love to see that happen. However, I think we're just going about it all the wrong way. To decrease our rosters to 11 makes no sense whatsoever. To have one goalie and 10 field players on a roster makes no sense.
Is that how it would be played? It would be 10 field and one goalie, or is that how you'd pick it?
That's how it would be played. I think I'm not sure whether you would have the option to have two goalies and 9 field players. I can't imagine anyone wanting to do that.
Yeah.
But I believe that you can have 10 field players and one goalie, which, you know, what happens if, for instance, your goalie goes down in the middle of the tournament? And, you know, the way it works for us now, unless they change these rules, is you cannot replace, once the tournament starts, you cannot replace anyone, no matter what, no matter injury or what. So if that were to happen, then you're sticking a field player in the goal, which, you know, becomes a complete joke for that team and our sport and that competition. And, you know, some would say, okay, well, why don't we just have someone else on the roster, like an alternate, and then why don't they change the rule in order to be allowed to have a goalie come in case of an injury? Well, that's great. I'd be supportive of that. However, the goal for the IOC, the issue with the IOC is the number of bed spaces, the number of people in the Olympic Village. So the reason why they're cutting it down to 11 is to decrease that. They're not going to allow a 12th player. That's the whole point in this. And then not to mention that you have 10 field players. I mean, we've played in games before where we've had four field players and five field players pick up three fouls. So, you know, what happens in that situation? So a lot to think about. And those are just some of the rules that talk about changing. And I hope that we spend a little bit more time in thinking about these things in depth. And obviously I'll be as curious as anyone to see where things go.
Would if you had to move forward on this and the rules stipulate that you are 10 field players and one goalie, if you think back to the last two Olympic teams you've selected, would that have changed what you did? Or at least how you thought about putting it together?
In terms of the just
the personnel you took, I mean, maybe with, you know, and obviously not looking to name any names here, but just, you know, maybe before, if you started from scratch, you would have said, well, you know what, I'd really rather have someone, maybe they're not as good as the other ones, but I'd really rather have someone that could play these two positions, because if we're in a pinch, we're going to need that person.
It wouldn't have changed what we did, because we had a team that was fairly versatile anyway.
Sure.
That, you know, we had a lot of people that could do a lot of different things. So in that sense, it kind of would work out perfectly for this type of format. Now, I can't say, you know, moving ahead, it's going to be the same situation. So, you know, you certainly, you know, back in the day when you have 11, you typically would have you know, two true centers, three defenders, maybe four defenders, and then the rest attackers and goalies. You know, I don't know if that's the case. And one of the also the changes is the 25-second shot clock.
Yeah.
So now you're playing, if that is the case, you're playing an up-tempo game. So you got to take all these things into account and, you know, without making any decisions. Obviously, I'm thinking if it's 25 seconds and 10 players, that's going to be even a larger requirement on...
well, on speed, right? I mean, then you're going to need a faster team. You're not going to be able to have the luxury of always setting up at 2 meters.
Right. So that kind of standard 2 meter player isn't quite as valuable as it has been before in the past. It's similar to what we saw in the last 2 years when they've gone to this 5-on-5 game.
Sure.
You know, it's a different game, and you have to be able to adjust. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. It should be very, very interesting.
Yeah, more to come on that. And for some context, before women's water polo was ever put in the Olympics back in 2000, the thought was that it was going to be an 11-person roster, and then it got increased to 13, which I know if you talk with anyone who was training for that team, that was a life-changing day because it meant that, you know, two people, not that they knew who they were, but you could add two more people to the mix. So more to come on that. As we close out, we finish with our usual ending segment, best thing we saw on the internet this week. And for me, it starts with just an excellent reported feature on the move of the Raiders from Oakland to Las Vegas. This was an ESPN magazine. And I'm just you know, kind of a nerd for excellent details in a story, and I will read a very long article, provided that it has a lot of those just kind of unique details, backgrounds, storylines, things that you can't get by just watching the 90-second report on, yep, it's official, Raiders are moving. So I'd recommend checking that out. That's on ESPN.com or in ESPN Magazine. But just the details of the Raiders owner, Mark Davis, and how people kind of thought he was a bit of a fool, and then he ends up working out this deal where he's dealing with one of the most wealthy folks in Las Vegas, and then that falls through. You know, he almost kind of, in a way, talks his way out of the deal a couple of times and is able to work his way back into it and kind of just sets it up where he has now gotten what he was looking to do and moving an NFL team to Las Vegas. Also, keep in mind, moving a team to a place where years back, even bringing that up, you'd be laughed at to say, what do you think about an NFL team in Las Vegas? And say, well, how about a team on the moon first? So it's impressive to see how all this has come together over the last several months for the move, but in general, the idea of warming to Las Vegas.
Wow, yeah. It's hard to imagine the Las Vegas Raiders. For me, just very quickly, it was just something I saw, I think, yesterday on the internet, and this is going back to my part ownership in the Warriors and for the playoffs. It's Steph Curry has cut himself off from all social media for the rest of the playoffs, and that's just a warning sign for the rest of the NBA and something that I've always encouraged even some of our athletes to do. I'm as a fan and as part owner of jokingly of the Golden State Warriors, I was excited to see that he's locked in and staying off his Instagram and his Twitter, and is going to be focused on the most important thing, and that's bringing the title back to the Bay.
Well, and not that he stole this idea, but that's what LeBron James does also. He has shut it down for a while, and I think there's some other guys that do it too, but you're right. I think it's become a statement to say, you know what, everyone? I'm so into this whole playoffs thing, you're not going to catch me on the Instagram, so just forget about it.
Yeah, good to see. Hopefully my athletes are over the watch. And sometimes we care a little too much about what we're putting on InstaFace, as Bill Belichick.
Yeah, you know, and Coach, your squads are only getting younger, so just keep fighting that good fight.
Oh, jeez, I know.
Well, that's the best we saw on the internet this week. Don't forget, big game Saturday. number one UCLA, number two USC, live in the Pac-12 Network. Coach and I will be there 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. That's going to do it for this episode of Mescal and the Coach. Thanks for joining us, and we will catch you next time.